We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Rich Brown about how alcohol affects the body.
And we're taking your calls. How do you see the effects of alcohol on your health? Do you drink alcohol for some of the health benefits you see in the paper sometimes? And do you have questions about how alcohol affects us, short or long term? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page to your calls in just a moment. But Dr. Brown, I understand that you have a lot of brain scans comparing how our brains work on and off alcohol. What kind of things do we see? How do they light up differently?
Yeah, well, they actually tell a fascinating story. And if you do a Google image search on PET scan alcoholism, these will come up. And the most instructive set of brain scans basically shows how a normal pleasure reward center works. And then a comparison scan shows how the pleasure reward system truly is hijacked. It shows the brain scan of somebody who is addicted. And then for that same individual, it shows how the scan has almost come back to normal a couple of years later after that person stayed clean and sober. So the PET scans have really made it very clear that, number one, we can see that this is truly a disease of the brain, of the pleasure reward system. And, you know, it's not an anatomic disease. If we did a biopsy, if we remove some brain cells from an alcoholic pleasure reward center, they would look normal. But the PET scan shows us how brain cells function. And the scan shows us that those cells are functioning abnormally, just like some people with epilepsy have abnormal function of their brain cells. So the PET scans really make it clear that alcoholism is a disease just as much as epilepsy.
We'll get to our callers now. We've got Lisa on the line in Green Bay. Lisa, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have two brief comments and then a question. My father was an alcoholic, referring to your guys' talk on family inheritance and the genetics of alcoholism. My father is an alcoholic for about 10 years, and of course, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, so he's recovering. And his brother is an alcoholic for life. He will die from his alcoholism, most likely. And to put it briefly, my father's alcoholism caused huge dramatic effects on my life and also the way I choose to use alcohol. Regarding why children who drink, people who drink earlier in life may have alcoholism affect them more in later on in life. Just the thought that I wanted to put out there because it has crossed my mind as being somebody in a situation. I started drinking hard liquor when I was 14, and I pretty much didn't stop binge drinking until I was 22, 23. Three years it was more mild, but one thing that I come to find is that it's a sort of a comfort thing. Not only do I have the environmental triggers of having my father be an alcoholic, but just in my own right, I find myself when I'm down or out or whatever, feeling I need a drink, that it's because I've always felt that way. I've had it for so long already, even though I'm so young. And then my question was for the doctor, you mentioned that the health effects, instead of thinking about your liver, think about your heart. I was wondering what research you might have or know about the effects on kidneys, considering there are filters for our body, and is that a link between alcoholism and increased kidney problems?
Gotcha. Lisa, thanks for the call. Let's start with that question, the kidney.
Yeah, you know, alcohol has some effects on the kidneys, but it's not the organ that people typically run into problems with. Yes, the kidney does filter, and alcohol can pass freely through the kidney into the urine. The part of the body that's really responsible for processing the alcohol and therefore the part of the body that's more exposed to its toxic effects is the liver. Mm-hmm. So most people will end up with liver problems way before they end up with kidney problems. But I do want to comment. Thanks for telling your story. It really illustrates some key points that alcohol is such a trap for young people. When you were 14 and you were drinking because it felt good, it helped you cope. Yeah, that is clearly one of the ways that alcohol makes us feel good. And it's only when you got older and could really bring some mature judgment to the situation, you realized it's time to slow down your drinking. So that's the trap for kids, is that kids often don't have the judgment. And it's a great illustration that the more we can do in our state and around our country to help kids stay away from alcohol, the more we can prevent them from developing alcohol-related harms and perhaps alcoholism in later life.
Lisa, thanks for the call, and good luck to you and your family. We'll go to Larry in Dubuque now. Larry, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, on a side note, I do drink alcohol now, and I enjoy a beer with dinner, stuff like that. But during college, it was very tough because even in late high school and early college, I was against drinking completely because I felt I didn't need it to really have fun, as you often hear. So going to different parties with a roommate or friends, people will just be so dumbfounded that you would decline a drink from them, and they just wouldn't accept your answer, where they keep asking, well, why don't you want a drink? You just say, well, you know, I don't want one, whatever. So I feel like the social pressure is very difficult when our culture just promotes this high type of drinking anyway.
Larry, thanks a lot for the call. That's a lot for public health people, for doctors to contend with, that massive social pressure to drink.
Yeah, and that is a huge issue, especially in our state where we lead the nation in binge drinking. When UW-Madison was keeping track, as I recall, about 65% of undergrads were engaging in binge or risky drinking at least once every 2 weeks. And it really does set up a harmful environment for individuals like you who prefer not to drink. So that's one of the reasons we really have to figure out how to change our alcohol culture to keep more people safe from binge drinking.
Larry, thanks for the call. To Reggie now with us in Milwaukee. Reggie, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just had one question. What does the doctor have, information you have on how alcohol affects intestinal health?
Interesting. So alcohol and our digestive system, the intestines.
Yeah. Actually, alcohol tends to be much more damaging to the stomach than the intestines. The stomach has, as I'm sure you know, the stomach produces acid to help with digestion. But the stomach lining protects the stomach from the effects of the acid after it produces it. Alcohol, unfortunately, disrupts the stomach lining, so it makes the lining of the stomach more susceptible to burning from the acid. And if that alcohol exposure occurs and the inflammation occurs over time, people can develop an ulcer. And if that irritation continues, some people actually develop cancer of the stomach.
So a lot of health-related problems to overconsumption of alcohol. How are doctors trying to contend with this? I know you work on screening programs for doctors to talk to patients about alcohol. What are you doing?
Yes, I direct a program at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health called WIPHL, W-I-P-H-L, the Wisconsin Initiative to Promote Healthy Lifestyle. And what we do is tend to help clinics around the state systematically ask their patients about their drinking. And if somebody says yes to some initial questions, we ask some more questions. And there's lots of research that shows if we can just have fairly brief conversations with people to get them to think about the pros and cons of their drinking, how their drinking relates to what's important to them in their lives, many people will make a spontaneous decision to drink less and keep themselves much safer from injuries, developing alcoholism in the long term, and lots of other negative impacts on their health, families, et cetera. So we've have a very successful program. We've helped dozens of clinics initiate these services. And one of the keys to success we've learned is we have to expand the healthcare team. Present doctors and physician assistants, nurse practitioners and nurses, although they clearly could learn to administer these services, they just don't have enough time. So we help clinics hire health educators. We train those health educators. And we've documented that those health educators do a great job at helping people reducing their drinking. And they're so successful, we're actually finding that these services also reduce the cost of healthcare. So what better service could there be than something that helps people be healthier and decreases costs at the same time?
We'll leave it there for now. Rich, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks very much for having me.
That was Dr. Rich Brown. He's a doctor and professor in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, with us to discuss the effects of alcohol on our health.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I. We'll find out what impact the Great War had on the world of literature.
First, oral arguments in the John Doe investigation appeal began at 2:30 this afternoon before the Seventh Circuit Court in Chicago.
The investigation was looking into whether or not Governor Scott Walker's campaign illegally coordinated with third-party groups in Wisconsin, like Club for Growth. That was halted by U.S. District Judge Rudolph Randa back in May as he decided there wasn't sufficient evidence to warrant continuing the investigation.
Prosecutors are appealing that decision. At stake today is whether or not the investigation into the Walker campaign's activities will continue. The decision could have some sway over the November 4th gubernatorial elections, but it remains to be seen if the Seventh Circuit Court will make a decision before that time.
Here with us now to talk about the arguments being made in court today, we have Howard Schwaber. He's a legal expert and professor of political science at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, nice to be here.
Well, the event that led up to this was U.S. District Judge Randa stopping this John Doe investigation. What was the reasoning there that brought us up to today?
Well, you have to back up a little bit to answer that question and ask what was at stake in the investigation in the first place. So there's a Wisconsin state law that says it's not lawful for a candidate and outside groups to do what's called coordinating. And the idea is it's perfectly okay for a group that favors a particular policy to take out an ad that says, you know, vote for low taxes. It's perfectly okay for a group that favors, let's say, Scott Walker for governor to take out an ad that says, vote for Scott Walker for governor. What would not be okay is for Scott Walker to coordinate with that group because that would go around all of the limitations on campaign financing. At that point, there would be unlimited financing because none of the traditional channels for campaign financing and campaign expenditures would be visible. That's particularly true because these groups can list themselves as social rather than political, and therefore can remain anonymous. And the disclosure laws don't apply to them, even though they're undertaking political advertising. So here we had a situation in which there was a guy in Scott Walker's office named R.J. Johnson, who was a key advisor, and he told Walker, you should tell all of the people interested in donating to your campaign to instead give money to Wisconsin Club for Growth. R.J. Johnson is also the chief advisor to Wisconsin Club for Growth. So he would then take off his Scott Walker hat and put on his Club for Growth hat and decide how that money would be spent on ads that would favor the governor. And this allegedly was not coordinating. In other words, the court found that R.J. Johnson was not coordinating with himself, which is kind of remarkable in a way. The reason is there's a two-part argument that Judge Randa relied on. First of all, because these were ads that did not say re-elect Scott Walker or don't recall Scott Walker, but only said don't recall a governor who cuts taxes or don't recall a governor who stands up to teachers' unions, they were not political expression.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, they didn't fit what's called express advocacy. They were only issue advocacy. And Randa concluded that where the Wisconsin law talks about political activity, it only includes express activity, advocacy that names a candidate. That's a bizarre statement in a way. The idea that it's somehow non-political to say, you know, elect a governor who favors low taxes, whatever you think of low taxes, is a strange interpretation of the law. Randa didn't invent that interpretation, though. It's actually, I mean, as artificial as it sounds, it's one that the courts have discovered before. But he then added a second argument, which is even where there is coordination of political activity, he said, there's no risk of corruption as long as the group spending the money shares the basic views of the candidate. And this is where we get into a territory that's really kind of crazy. Because the idea is, no matter what the level of coordination, right? The first argument was it all depends on the nature of the message. The second argument is, no matter what the message or the extent of the coordination, there can't be any fear of corruption involved because, after all, they agreed in the first place. So those are the two arguments that are going to the Seventh Circuit. And the Seventh Circuit, a panel of two Republican appointees and one Democratic appointee, will review those arguments and decide if they were a good reason to put a stop to the criminal investigation.
Right. That investigation is stopped now. In part today, prosecutors are hoping to reopen it. What case do they have to make to get the ball rolling again?
Well, it's not really clear. The factual case is pretty strong. That is, there was an inadvertent release of some email evidence back in August. And it's quite clear that Walker got this advice. It's quite clear. He told donors to give money to the Club for Growth. There are emails of one of his other advisors saying Governor Walker wants all money funneled through the Club for Growth. We're talking millions of dollars here. The Koch brothers are involved. Karl Rove is involved. It's quite clear Club for Growth coordinated the content and reviewed the content of advertising to make sure it was consistent with the message that Walker wanted. I think one of the best emails is from an advisor named Kate Doner. The governor wants all issue advocacy efforts run through one group to ensure correct messaging. So in other words, there's very little question on the facts that there was coordination going on. The case prosecutors have to make is a legal one. They have to persuade the Seventh Circuit that where there's that kind of coordination going on, the fact that the ads didn't mention Walker's name doesn't make them non-political. And they also have to convince the Seventh Circuit that where there's that level of coordination going on, the fact that the governor and the group supporting him share a general ideology doesn't mean that there's no possibility of quid pro quo corruption. Those aren't really factual questions. It really is much more a matter of the legal standard that's at stake.
And a lot of this is coming about because Club for Growth members brought lawsuits against the prosecutors saying, hey, this is violating our free speech rights. If we can't do our political activity, you're violating federal rights here.
Well, that's right. And interestingly, those lawsuits point out one of the fallacies in Randa's argument. Right. So Randa argues that the Club for Growth and Scott Walker agree on everything. Therefore, there's no favors they could buy from him, and therefore there's no risk of corruption. But the fact is that they don't actually have the same agenda. Club for Growth is using this case as a weapon to try and strike down all restrictions on outside advocacy spending. They're arguing they're a private group. It's private expression of political preference. It's protected by the First Amendment. And therefore, the entire system of laws limiting coordination should be struck down. Walker would just as soon not have that fight. The last thing Walker needs is to have that, you know, is to have himself associated with the attempt to completely end all control of campaign financing shortly before an election. So right off the bat, if you look at this case, you can see that one of the fallacies of Randa's arguments is that there's never a possibility that a candidate and a group who share a general ideology might nonetheless not have specifically the same goals. The other problem here is that the Walker case involves the Walker campaign controlling the message by the outside groups. But if you accept the argument that Club for Growth is making, the reverse is equally possible. That is, it's equally permissible for outside groups to say, we'll spend money on your behalf only if you give us prior approval of your message.
And another thing going on in the court today, this is, as you mentioned, some records have been released throughout this. This is a decreasingly secret investigation. And in the court today, the Wisconsin Newspaper Association wants all the records of this case to be unsealed. Club for Growth would like to keep some documents unsealed. What's the legal back and forth over the secrecy of these John Doe investigation documents?
Well, traditionally, John Doe investigation documents are confidential, and that's one of the reasons that they're John Doe investigations. The law is quite unclear on this score. The Wisconsin Journalists Association is arguing that these are essentially public records and therefore covered by the Sunshine and Public Records laws that were, you know, Freedom of Information Act kinds of laws, which are quite strong in Wisconsin. Walker would like to have everything sealed, frankly, and Club for Growth has kind of a mixed position. They want some of these things revealed. That's really uncharted territory. In the past, attempts to get records of this kind revealed have been rebuffed on the grounds that it's necessary for the prosecutors to preserve the confidentiality of the investigation, and the fear would be that releasing the documents would impair the fairness and accuracy and effectiveness of that ongoing investigation. In this case, given the amount that's been dumped already, and the amount that's already been presented in the press already, there's a pretty good argument that it's too late to close that barn door, and a full picture should be released. But that's going to require some balancing of factors by the court, and legally it's a murky question.
Are the documents we've seen this case in general affecting the race for governor in Wisconsin?
That's hard to say. It looks like the answer is no. But that's partly because the race for governor in Wisconsin was always close, and Walker has always had a strong core of support. There's always been an almost as strong core of opposition until the election turns on a relatively small group in the middle at this stage. It's not clear, however, that there isn't room left and time left for damage to be done or for an effect to happen one way or another. It's very unlikely that the Seventh Circuit will issue a ruling before the election. So most likely what we'll get out of this is a flurry of news stories, some more attention on these emails, and some more discussion of the roles that the various people have played. But barring the unlikely event of a decision by the Seventh Circuit unfavorable to Walker that comes before the election, I don't think this is going to have much more effect than it's had already.
Well, and whatever the ruling is, it isn't saying anyone is guilty or innocent of any charges. It's a red light or a green light on the future of the investigation itself.
That's absolutely right. So no one should assume that the outcome of the Seventh Circuit's decision has anything to do with whether anyone has done anything wrong or not. On the other hand, if Randa is overruled by the Seventh Circuit and the investigation is ultimately allowed to go forward, there's also a state judge who has to rule, it certainly will indicate that the prosecution is based on a theory of legal wrongdoing that could be recognized. And it's worth pointing out, a number of Walker's staff have gone to jail already for this.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Howard Schwaber, legal expert and professor of political science at UW-Madison, about the John Doe investigation case heard today at the Seventh Circuit Court in Chicago.
This year marks the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I. The Great War was unlike anything the world had ever seen, and it would go on to change the world in many significant and unexpected ways.
And that included the world of literature. According to our next guest, World War I was a turning point for writers across the globe. In the years of the war and the years after, writers channeled their energy into putting their war experiences into words, and that helped usher in a whole new era of literature unlike anything seen before.
Joining us now is Jen Shelton, Associate Professor of English at Texas Tech University. Jen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much.
So before World War I, what was literature like?
Well, literature before World War I had already begun the process of becoming what we now know as modernism. So there was a lot of experimentation going on. There were many manifestos being written that were rejecting the old ways of doing things. A lot of these experiments were technical in nature. So you can think about a text like Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist, which really tried to remake the novel in a new way. And that was published it was written before the war and published right about the time that the war was beginning. So those kinds of movements were already going on before the war ever started in response to a lot of the technological and social changes that came along because of modernity.
Now, World War I is known for being an especially brutal war, millions of lives lost, trench warfare, lots of horrors that, you know, people hadn't seen before, hadn't experienced and lived through. How did writers attempt to capture that?
Well, the big thing they did, and this is a little strange in some ways for us to think about, but the main thing they did was they tried to represent accurately the experience of being in that war and being in the trenches. They tried to portray it as it was and as it felt to them. And this was a profoundly new way to approach writing about war, because before, every time someone wrote something about warfare, it had to be couched in that there was glory there was honor there, that this was majestic and good and noble. And of course, the soldiers in the trenches, I mean, as you say, it was a horrible existence. You were being shelled night and day. Your clothes were full of lice, and rats were walking over dead bodies sticking out of the sides of the trenches. It was a horrible, horrible existence in the Flanders area. You were walking in a sea of mud. You had to walk on duck boards in order to avoid drowning in the mud. And so the soldier writers looked around and said, this isn't noble, this isn't glorious, this isn't honorable, this is hellish. And for what, right? Because, I mean, the other thing that we all know about the First World War, even if we don't know much about it, is that, tens of thousands of lives would be lost, and nothing would be gained by this. And so they rejected, when I talk to my students about this, I often use the example of Alfred Lord Tennyson. He writes a poem like The Charge of the Light Brigade, and it's a doomed mission that is all very noble and majestic, and the poem kind of, rockets along with its beautiful little rhythm. And the World War I poets utterly rejected that kind of poetic strategy.
Right, and there was poetry coming out of the trenches, wasn't there, that managed to get around some of the censorship of the brutality that might have applied to other forms of literature.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people, because it's poetry, right, it's not like a news report, and so you could send your poem to, the poems were published in newspapers back then. It's a funny thing for us to think about, but yeah, they were published in newspapers. People sent poems home to their families, and they were published in you know, local journals and so forth. Some poets, like Siegfried Sassoon, was already an established poet before the war began, and so he had a lot of literary connections. And he was able to have his poetry and also the poetry of other people that he met and whose poetry he admired. He was able to have that published in various kinds of newspapers, magazines, and journals. You know, sometimes these were published in pacifist journals, like the Cambridge Journal, you know, really trying to say, this is how horrible this war is, and that's the reason we need to stop it. So it was a way to communicate. You know, it wasn't an esoteric thing that people did just to amuse themselves, but it was a real way to communicate with the people back home and say, you know, this is the horror of this war.
Is it fair to think about this writing as a precursor to war journalism?
It is a precursor to war journalism. And, you know, books like All Quiet on the Western Front, which, you know, is published in 1928, which is a really big year for war memoirs and journals, that writer was a journalist. And so in portraying what he had experienced in the trenches in the most graphic way he could, he's using a lot of journalistic strategies, you know, to make it feel to the reader like this isn't an emotional account, this isn't about what it felt like, this is just what it was, right? And so in that way it really changed war writing, it changed war journalism, it certainly changed even the newspaper accounts at that time. You know, the initial response to the war was, hey, hurrah, we're going to war and we're going to beat whoever the other side is in 3 days and be back home again by Christmas. But in part because of this this creative writing coming out of the front, you know, even the newspapers began to say, oh yeah, you know, here's what's really happening over there. You know, toward the end of the war, you know, and then of course there was even more censorship because this was not to the taste of the governments who needed constant renewal of their resources at the front.
And did this leave a legacy of reluctance to get involved in war after World War I because of this documentation of what it was really like there on the front?
Yeah, the big years for war writing were the late 20s and early 30s. And this is just when the things are being set in place that are going to make World War II happen, and all, you know, everyone is reading these things really voraciously. You know, Mary Borden, who's an American writer, had written a book called The Forbidden Zone, which was about the experiences of being a nurse at a front line, kind of MASH-like hospital. And there was All Quiet on the Western Front, and there were tons of memoirs, Robert Graves's All Goodbye to All That, and Sassoon's memoir, and Edwin Blunden's memoir came out, and people were reading these things voraciously, and they were looking at this and saying, okay, we fought the last war, and what did we get from it? And, you know, we look at all this horror, look at all these losses, and what did we get? And it made the Europeans in particular very, very, very reluctant to go into another war. Of course, the exception to that would be Germany, which was really punished by the treaty that ended the First World War. And for them, it was a sort of a nothing to lose, I think, kind of feeling.
And Jen, in our last 30 seconds here, is there a line of poetry or an image from this kind of writing that stays with you and really makes you think about what it must have been like?
Well, you know, probably the most famous line is in Wilfred Owen's poem, Dulce et Decorum Est. At the end of the poem, he says, you know, he wants children to not hear, that old lie that is sweet and right to die for your country. And, you know, it's a really profound statement, I think, from him.
Jen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jen Shelton, Associate Professor of English at Texas Tech University. She joined us to talk about how World War I has changed the world of literature.